It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz, in for Kate Archer-Kent. Doorbells with video cameras. They can catch a porch pirate in the act of swiping your package. But they may also catch your neighbor in their bathrobe, maybe your neighbor's kids, without their knowledge. Police are starting to worry they're tipping off suspects who can watch them coming. But video cameras have also been a useful tool for law enforcement. More than 40 Wisconsin police departments partner with Amazon, the maker of the Ring doorbell, to request residents' private video footage. Are we inadvertently building our own neighborhood surveillance systems? Would you give police access to your video footage? Does it make you feel safer? We're at 1-800-642-1234. Our guest this morning raises questions about their use. Evan Greer is Deputy Director of Fight for the Future, a nonprofit advocacy group for digital rights. Good morning, Evan.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being here. So tell us about this program, this partnership that Ring, that Amazon has with police departments across the country.
Sure. I mean, you've got to hand it to Amazon, because this really was a fairly brilliant marketing ploy, if something that's also harmful to our communities. But what Amazon has done is they're sort of bone grafting themselves to law enforcement institutions across the country and turning our local police, funded through our tax dollars, into sort of a marketing arm for their surveillance products. So Amazon has entered into now thousands of these partnerships with police departments across the country, where police will offer subsidies or discounts on Amazon products, and or simply encourage members of their community to purchase these devices. And in exchange, the cops basically get VIP access to request footage from these cameras with basically no checks and balances or oversight in place to dictate what they can do with that footage once they collect it, if a homeowner decides to turn it over.
Okay, so break this down for me. Do police still need a warrant or a subpoena to get access to this data?
That is an excellent question, and unfortunately the answer is no. Really what this does is creates a technological end run around the Fourth Amendment. So rather than having to go get a warrant or a subpoena, police can now kind of press a button, send an email to dozens, hundreds, potentially even thousands of owners of these inexpensive, insecure cameras. And then any of those homeowners can basically press a button to send them the footage that they've collected. And again, there's currently really no laws or regulations in place that dictate how often police can do that, what purposes they can do it for, what types of crimes they can investigate by requesting footage from these devices. And they've openly admitted that once they do collect the footage, there's currently no rules in place dictating how long they can hold on to it, whether they can hand it over to other agencies like Immigrations and Customs Enforcement, for example. And so we know that what's happening here is this is creating sort of a dragnet where police can request enormous amounts of footage and use it for all kinds of things far beyond what perhaps the homeowner expected it to be used for. Just to give one concrete example, we know through public records requests that police in Los Angeles used footage from Ring cameras to monitor Black Lives Matter protesters over the summer in Los Angeles. So there's a clear example of this being used not to catch a package thief or stop a burglar, but to monitor First Amendment protected activity by individuals protesting for racial justice.
So doesn't Ring, I mean, Ring says on their terms of service that they don't release user information to law enforcement except in response to a, quote, valid and binding legal request properly served.
Right. So that's if the police went to Amazon and said, hey, we want this homeowner's footage. What the Ring Neighbors app and the kind of law enforcement portal that they've created does is it allows law enforcement to, again, request footage from homeowners. The homeowner gets a notification or an email that says, hey, the police in your area have requested footage from this particular time period, right? And they're supposed to have a good reason. They're supposed to be investigating a crime. But what we've seen is that, you know, police could request footage for a very serious crime. You know, perhaps a shooting has occurred or something like that. And of course, people are going to be willing to hand over their footage. But again, the problem is because these partnerships are being formed completely outside our democratic process, with no oversight from city councils or even mayors in most cases, there's nothing to stop the police from then using the footage they collect to bust some teenagers who were smoking weed in the park across the street, or for any number of other purposes far beyond that initial reason that a homeowner chose to hand over their footage to the cops. And again, the end result is that there's just more eyes and ears constantly watching our communities and our neighborhoods. And what we've seen in the numbers is that the proliferation of Ring devices is strongly correlated with a huge uptick in incidents of racial profiling. If you look at the Neighbors app, there is an enormous prevalence of people posting footage, photos, and videos of people who they say are suspicious in their neighborhood, many of whom are just people of color going about their daily lives, a delivery driver, someone walking their dog. And so what we know is that these devices, for the vast majority of people, they don't make us more safe. They actually introduce more risk into our communities by sort of turning neighbors against each other and exacerbating existing forms of discrimination and profiling that we already know are a problem in our society.
So how are they different, though, than neighbors? I feel like we've all had that neighbor that would the police come to their door, they would tell you what's going on in the neighborhood. They would, and maybe they would have opinions about the kids in the neighborhood that they would share, and maybe they were based in fact, maybe they were their own opinions, right? So how is this any different than neighbors kind of having suspicions about their other neighbors and sharing those with law enforcement?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think one way to think about it is imagine that that neighbor, and like you said, we've all had that neighbor, right? Imagine that that neighbor now has a surveillance camera trained at your front door from their front door and can watch every time you come and go. And, you know, they're not just looking out their window. They can do it when they're sleeping, right? And so, again, this creates this pervasive, constant monitoring of our communities, of our streets. And again, for me, it comes down to, again and again, there's no policy to protect people, right? One thing, for example, we know is that more traditional companies that sell CCTV cameras to businesses, tend to install those cameras in compliance with state CCTV laws, which vary from state to state. But many states have rules in place that say you can't install a camera on your home or business that's watching your neighbor across the street. It has to be monitoring your own property. Amazon puts into their terms of service that homeowners should comply with those laws too, but they know that the vast majority of people are going to get this device in the mail, open the box, and stick it on their front door and never think twice about whether it might be violating some law that they've never heard of. And so they're sort of flagrantly avoiding these statewide laws. It's early here on the East Coast. Sure. And earlier for you, they're sort of flagrantly avoiding these protections in place by sort of doing what they do across their entire industry, which is sort of outsourcing the problem, right? They outsource their drivers. They, kind of create externalities by underpaying their workforce. And now we see this example where they're creating what is essentially a privately owned surveillance empire or panopticon. And then they're throwing up their hands and saying, it's not our fault. It's the homeowners. They chose to put the camera there. The police request the footage. They said, yes, we're not responsible for anything that happens because of that.
We're speaking with Evan Greer, deputy director of the nonprofit group Fight for the Future, an advocacy group for digital rights. You're listening to The Morning Show. I'm Molly Stenz. The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stenz. Ring doorbells have grown in popularity in a few short years. They've also been hacked. A Mississippi family sued the company after their 8-year-old was accosted by a stranger on the internet who was able to break into the camera in her bedroom. Like a scene from a horror movie, the unsuspecting girl heard creepy music and then a strange voice suddenly coming from somewhere in her bedroom. Only this was real life. Do you have a doorbell with a video camera? Would you trust leaving a webcam on in your house? We're at 1-800-642-1234. Ideas@WPR.org. We're talking with Evan Greer of the nonprofit digital advocacy group called Fight for the Future. Evan, what are our rights when it comes to this data?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the short answer is we don't have very many. Again, because of the lack of policies in place right now to protect people from this type of private surveillance, again, which is distinct from government surveillance, right? If the police had installed these cameras, that would make a difference in terms of our civil liberties. But again, Amazon has kind of found this ingenious but evil way to circumvent those democratic protections and that democratic process. Again, if police wanted to install a camera on all of our front doors, surely we would have to have some city council meetings. There would be some public forums. People maybe would even get a vote. In this case, your neighbor can stick one of these on their door. And if it captures footage of you or your children or your family members or monitors your activities, when you come, when you go, you know, where you go, there's really not very much that we can do about that unless we start demanding some policies. And we have seen in some cities across the country, city councilors starting to talk about ordinances that could protect people and or demand that police end these partnerships that give them, again, sort of VIP access to the footage that these cameras are collecting. And I think that that's really the direction that we need to go in. We've seen ordinances across the country banning invasive surveillance technologies like facial recognition, which have exhibited systemic racial bias and have been shown to exacerbate existing forms of racial discrimination within our criminal justice system. Amazon Ring is no different. It's a different type of technology, but it has the same effect. And so this is really one of those moments where we need lawmakers to step in and put protections in place to sort of update the law for these modern times where we're not just dealing with cameras on businesses or cameras on police cars, but we're heading toward a world where you know, many, many people will have cameras on their homes, on their cars. We need protections in place so that our civil liberties don't slip away as the technology becomes cheaper and more expansive.
We're speaking with Evan Greer of the nonprofit digital advocacy group called Fight for the Future. And Evan, we've got callers who want to talk to you. Let's go to Michael in Elroy. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning. Thank you for the conversation. I'm neither a liberal nor a conservative. I'm a middle-of-the-road guy, and I grew up in a small town in southwestern Wisconsin where within the last 5 years there's been two meth labs busted. And I think this is largely a solution in search of a problem, because way more good's going to be done by this than bad. Now, if indeed you feel that laws need to be passed, well, let's get them passed. But again, I think it's a little bit overblown at this point. Thank you.
Thanks, Michael. Michael talking about drugs in his neighborhood and the fact that this can be a tool. This can be useful for actually preventing crime. What do you think?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, and thanks for the call, Mike. You know, I think it's really important that we always look at the broader societal impact, right? You know, any type of policy or technology comes with real trade-offs. And, you know, certainly there are real issues in our communities that need to be addressed. What I would argue is we need to think about this a bit more holistically. You know, rather than just slapping a camera on the front door, can we start addressing some of the underlying problems that tend to contribute to what we call quality of life crimes, right? Especially things like package theft, where for the most part, people are stealing packages and selling them to buy food or to take care of their basic survival needs. If we had some protections in place, some basic policies to make sure that people weren't slipping through the cracks that way, that's actually been shown to do a lot more to reduce crime than increasing surveillance. We've also seen even basic measures like increasing lighting in downtown areas, just more street lights. have a more significant impact on reducing crime without any of the kind of added forms of discrimination that we're talking about with this type of surveillance. And then, you know, to go back to your original introduction here, Molly, you know, it's really important that folks understand that these devices are also not secure. So even if you're less concerned about the privacy, civil liberties implications, it's really important to understand that putting a internet-connected camera on your front door or in your child's bedroom makes your family less safe, not more safe. And there are steps that people can take to make these devices a bit more safe, but Amazon especially has shown a significant track record of, you know, moving fast and breaking things, as is the adage in Silicon Valley. And they rolled these devices out and have been selling them rapidly, even when they knew they weren't particularly secure. And the fact is, there's no such thing as an internet-connected camera that's 100% secure. So if you ask me whether I would put one in my room or my kid's room, I would tell you, heck no.
Well, Evan, we've got another call for you. Matt from Nisita is joining us this morning. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning. So I think, to my knowledge, it's pretty well established in law, I think nationally, that you don't really have any expectation of privacy in public. Unfortunately, you know, I wish that weren't the case. But I think if we're going to point the finger or suggest laws be passed, it would be to prevent the government from surveilling, because they're doing it on such a ridiculously larger scale than, you know, Bob next door. To say that your neighbor can't have a camera, but, you know, Uncle Sam can everywhere all the time, I don't know. That's not where I guess I'd put my priorities. Thank you.
Thanks, Matt. I want to go to another question we have coming in for you, Evan. We've got Adam joining us from Deerfield next.
Sure.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, good morning, Adam. What was your question?
Well, I'd just like some clarification. The guest had spoke a couple of times about the police having access to the footage from the victim.
You're breaking up a little bit. You're asking about what access the police actually have?
Yes, because they have to get consent from the homeowner that has the Ring device. Isn't that correct? I mean, they can't just access that information without authorization from the homeowner.
Evan?
Yeah, so I can jump in on kind of both of these points, because I think they're actually very connected. You know, to the first caller's point about, you know, sort of Big Brother, I think that's actually an excellent point. And that's really why we are so concerned. This is not about your neighbor monitoring you. This is about the fact that Amazon has created what's called a law enforcement portal that allows police to request footage simultaneously from as many Ring camera owners as they want within a certain area. They can literally drag and drop. Imagine you're on Google Maps and say, give me all the Ring camera owners in this area and send them a message asking them for footage. So the second caller is right. It's not that they have direct access. They can't just turn on your camera and watch whenever they want. But what Amazon has done is they've created sort of a seamless, expedited process for them to request footage en masse, which is a form of mass government surveillance. It's being enabled by a private corporation and private homeowners, but the end result is no different than what the National Security Agency did that Edward Snowden exposed, in terms of creating a dragnet effect where the police are able to vacuum up enormous amounts of data. They get consent from a handful of homeowners, but they're not getting consent from the people who are captured by those homeowners' devices, who are maybe just walking down the street, or again, the kids playing in the park across the street. And so when we think about consent, when we think about opt-in in this circumstance, yes, you know, it is sort of a legal foundation that we don't have an expectation of privacy when we're in public walking down the street, but that doesn't mean that we have an expectation that our every move is being monitored by these devices, and that footage could be handed over to law enforcement and used for any purpose with absolutely no checks and balances, and that police could request footage en masse for any purpose with no checks and balances there. That's not traditionally how policing has worked. And really what it does is it removes incentives for police to focus their attention on more serious crimes, when they can just click a button and request footage en masse for even the most low-level infraction. Again, like some teenagers playing in a park, or someone stealing a package. I think we should have a higher bar for enabling this type of massive surveillance, given the harms that we've seen can come with it.
But Evan, consumers, they can reject these requests, right?
That's right. But again, what we see is, people who buy Ring cameras are many of them are those neighbors who you were talking about earlier, right? And so again, the difference here is previously, before devices like this, if a crime was committed and police wanted to go around and ask neighbors about it, they would have to dedicate some hours to it, right? They'd have to send some officers out, go knock on doors and ask people, hey, did you see anything? Now they can do it en masse with the push of a button, and that fundamentally threatens our basic human rights and the future of our democracy.
Sure. Well, that's all the time we have, Evan. But thank you for being here. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Evan Greer is the deputy director of Fight for the Future, a nonprofit advocacy group for digital rights. Up next is the news and the story of our Wisconsin life. Then we talk about a new program at the University of Wisconsin to study psychedelics. I'm Molly Stentz, and this is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a poem about a natural disaster's destruction.
When Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico and surrounding islands in 2017, it was devastating. The storm tore through communities, decimated cities and towns, and brought on widespread power outages. Countless people were injured, and more than 3,000 people died. Rebuilding in the aftermath has been slow and frustrating for its residents, as many have criticized the government's response. As Puerto Ricans living in the United States watched the disaster from afar, many felt powerless. It was hard to reach their family members and assist in a meaningful way. Poet Carl Michael Iglesias wanted to help in a way only he could. So the Milwaukee native and Brooklyn resident channeled his thoughts into a debut poetry collection, Catch a Glow. He shares the poem, Shuttered New, which he created from a series of newspaper clippings. Iglesias says it's about the mass exodus of students from Puerto Rico and the teachers who were left behind. Take a listen.
Shuttered New. Education announced closure. Schools erased in endless summer, taking into account sharp drop in enrollment amid island economic slump, families' departure, and American desks. Today, English only, first winter coat, New York radiator hiss, tropic piping haunting, fever that opens windows in January. In the coming weeks, Miss Torres to lose her job, joined strike in the mayhem after the police fire tear gas and pepper spray to end, gathered to oppose, decimate what remained, more to leave. We're overwhelmed, said the need to express our indignation. People who are suffering march down Gold Mile, heart of the financial district, bank buildings, glass high rises. They won't stop us, salsa blared. Scuffle in riot gear before a drizzle briefly dampened wooden shields, dressed in charcoal, covering faces with bandanas, tear gas. Chaos has been arrested and injured, covering windows with plywood and hurricane shutters. Standoff with police who fired downward. Spiral wrath, judge handling the island's bankruptcy, an entity not elected by the people. We found out from the press.
That was Milwaukee native Carl Michael Iglesias sharing the poem Shuttered New. He tells us about the inspiration behind the poem.
The inspiration behind the poem Shuttered New is the shuttering of hundreds of schools in Puerto Rico around the same time as Hurricane Maria. Post-Maria, over 40 schools were damaged so bad that they couldn't reopen. At the same time, I'm teaching a bilingual poetry class for middle schoolers in Brooklyn, and I welcome two students from Puerto Rico who moved in with the family in New York in order to go back to school. I was witnessing the diaspora in motion, and it was clear how Puerto Ricans were all a degree away from being affected by the hurricane. To dive into this moment a little bit more, I used snippets of newspaper clippings to compile parts of the poetic narrative. What inspires me the most to create is this self-realization that I have the responsibility to tell the story of my people, my histories, my family. It's my job to comment about the times and the moment around me, to try to document what it feels like to be alive. My book of poetry, Catch a Glow, is an exploration of how the Puerto Rican diaspora digested the effects of Hurricane Maria through journalism, the supernatural, and the people affected by it on the island and hundreds of miles away.
Carl Michael Iglesias is a poet, teacher, and actor based in Brooklyn. He grew up in Milwaukee and is a graduate of UW-Madison. His debut collection of poetry, Catch a Glow, was released earlier this year. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz. Psychedelic. It's a Greek word meaning mind manifesting, first used by the English psychiatrist Humphrey Osmond back in 1956. This was the doc who dosed novelist Aldous Huxley with mescaline. Huxley would later write The Doors of Perception about that experience. People have been using plants with psychoactive properties for long before that. Peyote, a cactus native to Mexico and the southwest U.S., is believed to have been used by humans for 5,000 years. But how much do scientists know about these chemical effects on our brains? Well, perhaps a whole lot more soon, now that UW-Madison is offering a new master's program to study their use. Would you be interested in psychedelics as a treatment option? Doctors, what would you want to know before you would consider prescribing them? What research needs to be done? We're at 1-800-642-1234. Cody Wenther is an assistant professor of UW-Madison School of Pharmacy. He's the director of the school's new Psychoactive Pharmaceutical Investigation Master's Program. Good morning, Cody.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. Tell us about this master's program. What exactly will it train students to do?
Yeah, the master's program is the first of its kind. We're very excited to offer it. It's designed as a fully online program that's going to train students in the use of psychoactive pharmaceuticals, which includes psychedelics, dissociatives, cannabinoids, many of these other growth areas, to try and understand the science and the clinical practice behind how these medicines are used. We're particularly interested in training students to enter the growth pharmaceutical industry surrounding the use of these substances, providing them with the tools to understand the data and also to work in an ethical manner and adhere to all the regulatory pieces surrounding the use of these compounds.
So your students would go on to gain their master's through the pharmacy school, and they would work for pharmaceutical companies that were interested in developing these treatments?
That is the primary target for our first cohort of students. Yes, that's correct. So there's a number of companies that have developed around this space, both with psychedelics and with cannabis, as well as a lot of not-for-profit institutes, including the USONA Institute here in Madison.
Sure, founded by the Promega founder.
That's right.
So what's the legal framework at play here? We know that some states have decriminalized, maybe even like Oregon legalized the use selectively, but I have to imagine there's a lot of red tape around getting access to these substances. What does that look like for you?
Yeah, there absolutely is. So in addition to heading up this master's program, I also have a research lab within the School of Pharmacy, as do many of my other colleagues who are teaching in this program. And so we are, you know, required to have Schedule 1 licenses to work with these compounds. Schedule 1 meaning these compounds currently have no medical accepted use, according to the DEA. And that is, as you point out, a little bit at odds with how These compounds are being treated in a legal framework in some of our states, and also a bit at odds with some of the guidance now coming out of FDA. So both MDMA, which is commonly called ecstasy, as well as psilocybin, which is the active component in magic mushrooms, have been designated as potential breakthrough therapies for the treatment of PTSD and depression, respectively. So you can see there's a little bit of tension between how the DEA is continuing to classify these as Schedule I drugs with no accepted medical use, but the FDA showing overtures regarding the promise that these therapeutics or potential therapeutics are exhibiting in early stage and later stage clinical trials.
So is there enough of a supply chain to get you the manufacturing of these drugs that you can use legally?
Yeah, so that's actually one of the things that USONA Institute it's part of their own personal mandate that they've put out, is that they have a very open science model. And so they've helped support the manufacturing of pharmaceutical grade psilocybin. And that's some of what we're using in my laboratory as well as in the trials.
We're speaking with Cody Wenther, assistant professor at UW-Madison School of Pharmacy, and he's the director of the school's new master's program that will prepare students to research the therapeutic effects of psychedelics and other psychoactive substances. Do you have a question? We're at 1-800-642-1234. So, Cody, you mentioned PTSD and depression. What other promises do you think these drugs hold?
Yeah, I think those two have the most data right now in regard to potential indications for these therapeutics. So MDMA is in those very latest stage of clinical trials for PTSD, psilocybin in the phase just before that for depression. But other areas that we're studying here at UW-Madison that are a bit earlier but show a lot of potential promise are use in substance use disorders, things like opioid misuse or methamphetamine misuse, which, as we know, have been causing lots of morbidity, right, deaths and mortality over the previous years.
Huge.
Talking about tens of thousands of deaths, you know, per year, just with the opioid epidemic alone. So those are some, that's one big area. The other big area that received a lot of interest is anxiety, and particularly end-of-life anxiety for those individuals who may be facing a terminal diagnosis. Some of the earlier human trials were actually in patients with terminal cancer diagnoses, and use of these compounds with psilocybin in particular, with a single dose or two doses combined with psychotherapy, showed huge improvements in those patients' anxiety, quality of life.
So how do they actually work? How do they help people?
That's a great question. Some might say, you know, billion-dollar question. And we know a lot more about that than we once did. But there's a few layers of how these compounds are thought to work. So the first thing to recognize is that there is a little bit of a different framework for the application of some of these psychedelics than many of our other psychoactive therapeutics, where instead of just getting a pill and calling it a day, the use of these compounds is embedded within a psychotherapy framework. So people get prepared with a trained therapist to what to expect. They're provided with guides who will help them through the experience as it's occurring, and then there are integration sessions afterward. So it's likely an interaction of both what the drug itself is doing as well as that psychotherapy is the first layer we should talk about.
Sure.
The next layer down is what the drug is actually doing. And one of the things that I find really fascinating about these compounds is that they change the connectivity between regions of the brain. So regions of the brain that may talk to each other a lot normally tend to talk to each other less while these compounds are on board. Regions of the brain that don't talk to each other very much talk to each other more when these compounds are on board. And they even change the structure of the neurons, right? Those are the cells that make up your brains, causing new growth and reforming the spines that make up synapses that help those cells communicate, which is one of the reasons we think that people can have new learning, growth, and experience.
Interesting. We're speaking with Cody Wenther. He's an assistant professor at the UW-Madison School of Pharmacy. And you're listening to The Morning Show. I'm Molly Stentz. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz. We're speaking with Cody Wenther, an assistant professor at UW's Madison School of Pharmacy. He's the director of the school's new Psychoactive Pharmaceutical Investigation Master's Program. It's a two-year program, which the UW says is the first of its kind in the country. What do you wish we understood about psychedelics and their potential medical uses? Join us. We're at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us ideas@wpr.org. Cody, you were talking about opioids and the potential for psychedelic use there, maybe for folks struggling with addiction issues. Can you explain how that works?
So the potential of psychedelics to treat substance use disorders is certainly earlier in its study than for some of these other disorders that we've been talking about. So we'll have to see in trials, whether or not this actually ends up helping people in a robust manner. What we can say is it's probably very likely safe to treat them with these compounds because they've been shown to be safe, you know, this far in treatment of a number of psychiatric disorders. But to go back to your central question there, which is how might they act to work in opioid use disorder and other use disorders, one of those things that we were talking about earlier was the idea that certain areas of the brain talk to each other more commonly than other areas of the brain. And in addiction and other substance use disorder issues, including opioid use, over time, certain regions of the brain associated with reward become stuck in the same pattern, that they talk to each other too much and that they continue to press people to seek out the substance. And some of that rewiring that we were talking about earlier may be useful in breaking up those negative, maladaptive patterns of behavior that people are exhibiting when they're seeking out opioids and, you know, ultimately progressing to harmful addiction.
So how long do you think it's going to take this country to fully embrace the work that you're doing and the research that you're doing?
I think we've seen a lot of positive change in terms of openness to asking the questions. And I think that's the most important first step, is for us to not get caught up in the hype and say, this is absolutely a 100% guaranteed cure for all of societal ills. I think that's a mistake. But I also think it's a mistake to ignore the promise that these compounds are exhibiting. And so what our program does and what we as scientists do is weigh the balance of the evidence, look at safety and efficacy. And I think there's been a lot of positive movement towards allowing us to do that sifting and winnowing to find the truth that we at UW are so famous for.
Sure. And Cody, we have a caller joining us now that has a question for you. Good morning, Rachel.
Hi. So as someone who has complex PTSD, I'm just curious as to a more in-depth explanation of what they're studying in regards of therapy for PTSD through psychedelics. I've seen like some examples of exposure therapy and things like that. Could you go more into that?
Great question.
Sure. Yeah, thank you so much. Great question. So our trials with PTSD here at the UW are with the compound MDMA, which, as I said, is sometimes commonly called ecstasy. And that's a trial sponsored by MAPS. And it's in phase 3. And the model for that is again, the psychotherapy, psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy model, where patients are brought in with a counselor. They talk about the origins of their PTSD, what their feelings are related to the triggers that may be causing their PTSD, and get a sense of the person, the self. And only then, after they've been prepared for the drug administration itself, are there three doses of the MDMA in the presence of the therapist. And then there's also the integration sessions afterwards, where they talk through the insights that were gained during the drug sessions themselves.
And you mentioned the clinical trial is in phase three. How large is that?
We're talking about hundreds of patients in a phase three trial. I don't have the exact number in front of me right now, unfortunately.
Okay. And are you collaborating with other, is there other research being done at other Big Ten universities on this issue?
There's definitely research being done across the country on this issue. Some of the big players that have been working on this include Johns Hopkins University, NYU, the University of California, Berkeley, and others. Actually, Purdue University, which is my alma mater, had a famous medicinal chemist, Dave Nichols, for many years, who has taught us a lot about how these compounds actually work to bind at their target, which is a particular serotonin receptor, and help us to understand the science behind the chemistry and how it fits with the biology.
Sure. How do you find people to be participants in your trials?
So calls for the trial participation go out like other clinical trials. They're posted on clinicaltrials.gov. You can look up different clinical trials that are ongoing, contact the sponsors or the sites to get involved. For many cases, the psilocybin trials have filled up, the psychedelic trials have filled up very quickly. There are some limitations to who is eligible for these trials. We do want generally medically healthy people because we are still in the investigation phase and want to make sure that we're using this in a safe population. But there's been enormous enthusiasm from a lot of people who aren't getting the benefits they desire from their current therapies to join these trials. And that's exciting to see. But one thing that I think can be improved in this space for sure is the diversity of enrollment in these trials. There's been less diversity and less representation of normal Americans than is desirable in these trials.
Sure. Well, Cody, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Yes, thank you so much. Anyone who's interested can apply by July 31st for our fall 2021 cohort.
Thank you. Cody Wenther, assistant professor at the UW-Madison School of Pharmacy. Just ahead, we look at the threat of cyber weapons and how governments use them. I'm Molly Stenz, and this is The Morning Show.